You are about to embark on a journey of discovering the keys to the art of effective teaching and communicating by personal growth expert and life strategist, Gary Cox. Being an effective teacher and communicator enables you to have more influence in your life and gives you ability to persuade people to get your message and ideas across. Without effective communication skills, it's impossible to have influence over others, to direct and lead. Gary walks you through his years of experience to take you to the next level as an effective teacher and communicator. It's time now to listen as Gary Cox takes you on a journey to discover the keys to the art of effective teaching and communicating.
From as early as I can remember, I've always been fascinated with how we learn and what we can do to improve our learning skills and comprehension. More importantly, I discovered the advantages of being able to assimilate information and to be able to effectively teach others so that they can comprehend information quickly too. You know, we truly are capable of so much more, and we really can get a full sense or a full appreciation of that when we tap into the mind. One of the greatest advantages that I think you're going to learn in this program is how to cut your learning time in half or by three-fourths. That's a lot. You'll also learn how to teach other people in such a way that they will learn whatever it is that you're trying to teach them in the same manner, in less than half the time of what it normally would take. Also, if you believe that time is money, then you'll already see why listening to a program like this can be very valuable. Well, not to bore you, but let me first share with you how I got involved with learning techniques and then how I created techniques to improve on what I was taught. I first started all this while I was in high school, 10th grade to be exact. Now, I hate to admit it, but I hated school. It just wasn't for me. Anyway, you know in school that you have some teachers who really care about their students and the curriculum that they put together, and then on the other hand, well, you seem to have some teachers who really don't. Well, I felt that my 10th grade history teacher was one who really didn't care. Here's what he would do. At the beginning of the six-week semester, he would pass out several pieces of paper with questions and multiple-choice answers that dealt with our subject of history. So for the next 6 weeks, all we would have to do is find the answers to the questions. So we basically got to class, and we looked through a book to get all the answers, and that was it. He just sat at his desk, and he didn't really say much. At other times, he'd leave the classroom for, you know, really lengthy periods of time. He also told us that the very same information that he gave us at the beginning of the semester will be the same information for the final exam. I'm smelling an A on that test. Now, being that I hated school, and I hated studying even more, common sense told me that I just needed to memorize the answers. Now, remember, the answers were what? They were multiple choice. How much easier could it get? Now, a few days before the final exam, he said, whatever we got on the test, that is what our final grade would be. Now, I'm really smelling an A here for sure. Now, there was a student beside me that heard the teacher say that, and he was obviously very worried. See, out of the 6 weeks, he showed up for class maybe 7 or 8 times, if that. So his chances of passing weren't looking very good. But I had what I thought was a great plan for him. I asked the teacher if he wouldn't mind if I spent some one-on-one time with him to help him pass his test. He said, okay. So I only had 15 minutes before the test was handed out to help him. So here's what I did. It was easy. The test was multiple choice. So let's say the multiple choice answer for question one was A. The second multiple choice answer for question two was B. And let's say the third was A. Now, if you put all those three answers together with the letters, the A, the B, and the A, it sounds like ABBA. So all I did was to get him to memorize the entire test like this. He passed, and if my memory serves me right, he passed with an 87. Boy, if I had known that he could have skipped 6 weeks of class and passed, I would have skipped with him. So that was my first little experience where I actually got to put my ideas into action. That was just the beginning. As you may already know, I started my second business at age 15. I was fortunate to get into the jewelry business, and I was in it for over 13 years. I guess you could say it was very good to me. Now, one of the first things that I learned in that business was how to repair jewelry. That included fixing or soldering, as we call it, soldering gold chains. Also, we sized rings and set stones, such as maybe, you know, diamonds or rubies. Now, when I was in the business and when I soldered gold chains, you could charge about $6 for the repair. The average jeweler could do about, oh, maybe 5 or 6 repairs per hour. So let's say best case scenario, the jeweler did 6 per hour. Multiply that times $6 per solder, and you're doing about $36 an hour in business. Being that I eventually had other jewelers working for me, I needed to increase my profits. So the obvious question that came to my mind was, what is stopping a jeweler from fixing 10 or 15 gold chains in an hour? I could double my revenue in this department if I could accomplish this. The next consideration was, if it could be done, could it be done without sacrificing quality? So I was now on a mission to see if I could make this happen. Now, after some time, I was able to actually do as much as 20 chain solders per hour and match or beat the quality of my competitors. I knew that I was onto something. That created another idea. Would I be able to teach someone else to accomplish that and to be able to do it just as quickly? Well, I was also able to do that. This led to even more. Could I teach someone who had absolutely no experience in the business, could I teach them to fix gold chains in the same time frame? Now, that would be a challenge. My goal now was to create techniques to do this, and it became very successful. That then led me to creating a one-day jewelry course where I claimed that I could teach you how to solder gold chains, size rings, and set stones. That's right, all in one day. Not only did I teach all that in one day, I had my students repairing jewelry better than some jewelers that had been doing it for years. And that led me to yet another project that I designed. I put together a kit that was no bigger than a duffel bag, and in that kit were all the tools needed to do repair for most jewelry. I would actually take this kit into people's homes and repair their jewelry right at their kitchen table, right in front of their eyes. It was really an incredible concept. Now, this all stemmed from understanding how we learn and how to push the envelope with regards to what we can accomplish, especially when we have the right mindset. Well, I hope I'm not boring you, but let me share with you one more story, and we'll get right to it. I wanted to take these teaching skills even further, so I tried it in aviation. Now, I've been around airplanes from a child, and I just couldn't wait to get my pilot's license. Now, if you already don't know, pilots usually fly from the left seat of the airplane. Now, I remember when I was a kid, my uncle would take me up in the airplane, but he would put me in the right seat. No, I wanted the left seat. I wanted to feel like I was the pilot. I wanted to push the buttons and pull the knobs. So when I got my pilot's license, I soon got familiar with flying from the right seat or the co-pilot seat. Now, the reason I did that was that if I took my friends up with me, I would let them fly from the left seat or the pilot seat. They would love it. So here I am. I'm flying from the co-pilot seat. That's usually where the flight instructor flies from. And I'm letting my friends get to sit in the pilot seat. And I would let them fly the airplane a bit and do little tasks in the cockpit. They loved it. Now, you're not going to believe where all this is leading me. Well, here we go. What if I could teach someone who had no previous aviation experience to take off and land an airplane in less than 2 hours? That's right, less than 2 hours. And remember, it takes up to 10 to 15 hours to teach someone to do that. Sounds like a great stunt to me. So here I am. I'm not a flight instructor, and I'm claiming that I could teach this task by strictly understanding certain ways of how we teach and how we learn. Now, to prove this, I first needed a guinea pig, so I chose my brother-in-law. Why not, right? Anyway, to have the odds in my favor, I wanted to test my techniques on someone with an above-average IQ, which he certainly had. So if I was successful teaching him, then I could determine if others could accomplish this same feat. Well, you talk about sweating at the palms. No, not him, me, but we did it. Imagine having no experience with flying, and now you can land and take off an airplane on your own in less than 2 hours as I'm just sitting beside you watching. This is truly an incredible example of what we're capable of doing when we understand certain concepts of human behavior and how we learn. One of the reasons that I've mentioned all of this to you is that I will be referring to some of these stories throughout the program. This will give you deeper insights, and you'll be able to see how you can use this knowledge personally and how you can share it with others. Now, a lot of the information that I'll be sharing with you in this program will obviously come from my own personal experiences, such as those I've already shared with you, and also the training syllabus that I learned from when receiving my certified flight instructor's rating. Much of the information is verbatim and taken from a government handbook directed by the DOT, or the Department of Transportation, and the FAA. Now, I'm not one to believe everything I read, so some of the information I share with you from the government handbook I don't totally agree with, and I will let you know those subjects and why I don't agree with them. Now, I'm going to discuss practical ways that we can dramatically accelerate our learning ability and become better teachers or instructors. Now, the first thing that we're going to start off with is the learning process. To define learning, it is necessary to analyze what happens to the individual who is doing the learning. As a result of a learning experience, an individual's way of perceiving, thinking, feeling, and doing may change. Thus, learning can be defined, you want to note this definition, as a change of behavior as a result of experience. The behavior can be physical and overt, in other words, obvious, or it can be intellectual or attitudinal, not easily seen. So if we want to be effective teachers and good learners, it's important that we understand this. Now, there are four characteristics of learning that I'm going to share with you. Learning is purposeful, learning comes through experience, learning is multifaceted, and learning is an active process. Let's start off with the first one. Learning is purposeful. As we teach a student something, each student sees a learning situation from a different viewpoint. Each student is a unique individual whose past experiences affects their readiness to learn and to understand the requirements involved. For example, let's say that I have two people that I'm going to spend time with them to teach them how to increase their performance level in their business. Now, one client really listens intently to what I have to say and, more importantly, follows through in what I share and sees the benefits of applying the information that I shared with them. The other client doesn't seem as interested with what I have to say. There doesn't seem to be much effort to follow through with what I taught. Why the difference in attitudes? The first client, because of their background, their goals, and other reasons, realizes the value of the information that I shared with them. In other words, for this person, learning is purposeful. He or she has a reason or a purpose as to why they need or want to learn the information. The other person didn't have strong reasons or a good enough purpose as to why they should learn and apply the new knowledge. The responses differ because each person acts in accordance with the requirements seen in the situation. Now, many people have fairly definite ideas about what they want to do and achieve. Their goals sometimes are short-term, a matter of days or weeks. On the other hand, their goals may be carefully planned for a career or a lifetime. Each student has specific purposes and goals. Now, here is a very good point to remember. We learn from an activity that tends to further our purposes. So in the learning process, the learner's purpose is of paramount significance. An effective teacher or instructor seeks ways to relate new learning to the student's goal. Interesting. Now, the next characteristic of learning that we're going to discuss is the fact that learning comes through experience. Yes, learning is an individual process. This simply means that the teacher cannot do the learning for the student. Knowledge can't be poured into the student's head. Oh, it'd be nice if we could all learn that easily, but we don't. We learn only from individual experiences. You see, learning and knowledge cannot exist apart from a person. In other words, a person's knowledge is a result of experience, and no two people have had identical experiences. Here's what I mean. Even when observing the same event, two people react differently. They learn different things from it according to the manner in which the situation affects their individual needs. Previous experience conditions a person to respond to some things and ignore others. Isn't that interesting? So then all learning is by what? It's by experience, but it takes place in different forms and in varying degrees of richness and depth. For instance, some experiences involve the whole person, others only maybe the ears and memory. Therefore, the instructor or teacher is faced with the challenge of providing experiences that are meaningful, they should be varied and appropriate. For example, by repeated drills, students can learn to say a list of words, or by rote, they can learn to recite certain principles of whatever it is that they are learning. However, they can make them meaningful only if they understand them well enough to apply them correctly to what? To real situations. Now, if an experience challenges the learner, if it requires feelings, thoughts, memory of past experiences, and physical activity, it is more effective than an experience in which all the learner has to do is commit something to memory. Now, let me go over some of what I just said. There are some key clues here to being an effective teacher and communicator. If an experience challenges the learner, if it requires feelings, thoughts, memory of past experiences, and physical activity, it is more effective than an experience in which all the learner has to do is commit something to memory. Now, recall earlier that I mentioned to you how I was able to develop techniques in which I could take someone who had never flown an airplane before and teach them how to land and take off in just under 2 hours, where normally that would take 10 to 15 hours. Now, I know you're probably not investing your time to listen to this program to teach someone how to fly, but I hope you will find what I'm about to share with you to be enlightening. What you really want to understand here are the principles of what I'm teaching. Once you have an in-depth understanding of the principles, your ability to grasp new knowledge will dramatically increase, and your ability to help others change their behavior should increase too. Remember, that's how you know if you're a good teacher, by your ability to share knowledge and the listener change their behavior as a result of an experience. But my challenge to you is, how quick can you get someone to change their behavior? Make it fun, and more importantly, make it last. So let me share with you some of the principles of the two-hour flight experience. Keep in mind, my objective with this experience is to teach someone how to land and take off an airplane in less than 2 hours. Again, that's a task that usually takes 10 to 15 hours. Now, one of the very first challenges someone will encounter when beginning this two-hour flight experience is the fact that they have to learn how to drive the airplane on the runway. That is what pilots refer to as taxiing the aircraft. Well, why is that a challenge? Because it's completely contrary to what you've learned about driving. How do you drive or steer a car? You use the steering wheel, right? In the airplane, the steering wheel, if you will, is called the yoke. If you steer with it on the ground, it does nothing for you, absolutely nothing. So now let's say for the first time, you get into the cockpit and I ask you to steer the plane, and I explain to you that you control the plane steering by the foot pedals that are on the ground in the airplane, on the floor. Now, you've been programmed for years to steer with a steering wheel. So you see that we're taxiing the airplane and it starts to go over to the left. So what do you automatically do? You grab onto the yoke and you turn just opposite. You turn to the right so you can straighten it back up. Now remember, while on the ground, you can turn that yoke all you want, but it will do nothing for you. You'll get nowhere. Let's go back to one of our principles. Learning comes through what? It comes through experience. So then for you to break the bad habit of trying to steer the airplane with the yoke and try to start using the foot pedals, or rudders as we call them, you need to practice. Practice gives you what? Practice gives you experience. So what you're actually trying to do is break a bad habit and create a good new one. Now, if I were to teach you like normal quote-unquote flight instructors would, I would verbally correct you. I would say, use the foot pedal, not the yoke. And sooner or later, you would figure it out. Now, keep in mind, I'm trying to teach you all of this and much more in less than 2 hours. Now, some people claim that you have to do something 21 times for you to change your behavior. If this were true, you would have to taxi at least what? At least 21 times before you'd figure it out. Now, that's a lot of time, and that's why it normally takes 10 to 15 hours to teach somebody these flying skills the normal way. Now, let me share with you my thinking on the viewpoint that it takes doing something 21 times before you can change your behavior. Absolute nonsense. I'm going to share with you how I break a person's bad habit of trying to steer the airplane like they would steer a car and get them to quickly learn to steer with the foot pedals. Now, we already know that learning comes through experience. If an experience challenges the learner, requires feelings, thoughts, memory of past experiences, and physical activity, it is more effective than an experience in which all the learner has to do is commit something to memory. Now, with all that in mind, here's how I would break your habit of steering with the yoke. Now, remember, we're starting to taxi the airplane, and it slowly veers to the left. And because of your driving experience, you immediately reach over for the yoke. The moment you touch the yoke, I immediately reach over and slap your hand. That's right, I slap your hand. Now, of course, I don't do it very hard. Now, I remember once sharing this idea with a flight instructor to help him better his training skills, and he thought I was nuts and that my idea was stupid. See, he didn't get it. You don't just reach over and slap the person's hand. You have to have a sense of humor while you're doing it. You kind of reach over and slap their hand and say, ah, 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 you know, and you do it with a smile. You have to have a sense of humor and some personality. That flight instructor, unfortunately, had neither. Anyway, now, let's really analyze what I've done. By me slapping you, I am doing more than giving you a verbal command. Of course, in this case, the verbal command would be, don't use the yoke, steer with the foot pedals. You're taking that in audibly. Now recall, if an experience challenges the learner and requires feelings, that it is more effective. So what's the feeling in this case? Ah, that's right. It's the slapping of the hand. It shocked your nervous system, which may be perceived as negative, but it's really not. It did create a memorable experience. Now, you veering to the left and then trying to correct it on your own by turning the yoke and then figuring out, oops, oh, that doesn't work. Oh, I forgot. I've got to use the pedals, is also a negative experience, but not physically or psychologically as painful. So maybe, yeah, that's why you have to do it 21 times over and over again before you figure it out. See, the slapping of the hand and the verbal instruction creates a higher intensity of physical and psychological pain, which in turn changes the behavior, but it does it quickly. Yes, learning comes through experience, but it doesn't have to be repetitive if you know what you're doing. Now let me tell you, it works. It's humorous to watch a student begin to touch the yoke after the first slap. They, by habit, the second time want to reach over and try it again, but this time, the moment they touch it on their own, they just pull their hands back as if they're being literally shocked. They got the message, and learning is now accelerated. Isn't that interesting? The next area of learning that we're going to talk about is the fact that learning is multifaceted. Now, this simply means that a student will often learn more than what you expected. Now, psychologists sometimes classify learning by types, such as verbal or conceptual, perceptual, motor, problem-solving, and emotional. Now, however useful these divisions may be, they are what we call artificial. For example, a class learning to apply the scientific method of problem solving may learn the method by trying to solve real problems, but in doing so, it also engages in verbal learning and sensory perception at the same time. Now, each student approaches the task with preconceived ideas and feelings, and for many students, these ideas change while or as a result of experience. So the learning process, therefore, may include verbal elements. They may include conceptual elements, perceptual elements, emotional elements, and the elements of problem solving, all taking place, all of this at one time. So learning is multifaceted in still yet another sense. While learning the subject at hand, students may be learning other things as well. They may be developing attitudes about what is being taught. Either it's good or bad, depending on what they experience. Now, under a skillful instructor, they may learn self-reliance. In other words, the list can really be seemingly endless. This learning is sometimes called incidental, but it may have a great impact on the total development of the student. Now, the next area of learning that we're going to talk about is the fact that learning is an active process. Now, this is a very good point to remember. A teacher can't assume that students remember something just because they're present in the classroom. Neither can the instructor assume that the students can apply what they know because they can quote the correct answer from a book. So here's the key point. For a student to learn, they must react and respond, perhaps outwardly, maybe even inwardly, emotionally, or intellectually, but they have to respond. But if learning is a process of changing behavior, clearly that process must be what? It must be an active one. Now, let's take some time and discuss the laws of learning. We're going to go over about six of them. There's the law of readiness, the law of exercise, the law of effect, the law of primacy, the law of intensity, and the law of recency. One of the pioneers in educational psychology was a gentleman by the name of Professor Edward L. Thorndike. Early in the 20th century, Professor Thorndike came up with several laws of learning. Now, these rules or principles seem generally applicable to the learning process. Now, in the years since, other psychologists have found that learning is more complex, and more complex of a process than some of the laws suggest. Now, while Professor Thorndike's laws seem to have significant exceptions, they still provide an insight into the learning process, and they're included in this section for that reason. The laws that follow are not necessarily as Professor Thorndike stated them. During the years, they've been restated and supplemented, but in essence, they may be attributed to him. The first three are the basic laws as originally identified, the law of readiness, the law of exercise, and the still accepted law of effect. The following three laws were added later as a result of experimental studies, and that was the law of primacy, the law of intensity, and the law of recency. The law of readiness, let's go over that one. Obviously, individuals learn best when they are ready to learn, and they do not learn much if they see no reason for learning. Now, here is where I want to interject something. Again, individuals learn best when they are ready to learn, and they do not learn much if they see no reason for learning. Now, let's analyze this statement. You know, before people hire me for one-on-one consultations, I'm often asked, what is my success rate? It's a very open-ended question. Though it may sound a bit sarcastic, a good answer could be, well, you'll learn the best when you're ready to learn, and you do not learn much if you see no reason for learning. Now, some people say they are ready to learn or change, but they really aren't. How many people do you know that say, oh yeah, they're ready to lose weight, they're ready to go on a diet, and they get started, and they fizzle out shortly thereafter? Now, I could not tell you the amount of people that I deal with that say that they're ready to learn, and they say and they seem to have good reasons for learning and changing, but they don't. Saying you have reasons to change is good, but following up on those reasons is what will get results. So then, the more intense your reason is for learning or changing, the more active you will be, and usually you will learn in a shorter and more accelerated period of time. So if students have a strong purpose, a real clear objective, and a well-fixed reason for learning something, they make more progress than if they lack motivation. Readiness implies a degree of single-mindedness and eagerness. So when students are ready to learn, they meet the instructor or the teacher halfway, and this simplifies the instructor's job, doesn't it? Now, under certain circumstances, their personal problems may seem insoluble, so students may have little interest in learning during these particular times, and that makes sense. Now let's go over the law of exercise. The law of exercise. This law states that those things most often repeated are best remembered. It is the basis of practice and drill. The human memory is not infallible. We all know that. The mind can rarely attain, evaluate, and apply new concepts or practices after a single exposure. So we learn by applying what we've been told and applying what we've shown or been shown. Now, every time practice occurs, what happens? Learning continues. So the instructor, or you as a teacher, must provide opportunities for students to practice or repeat, and they must see that this process is directed toward a goal. Now, that all sounds great. Now, let's jump back to our 2-hour flight experience. How is it that I can accomplish this task in less than 2 hours? The reason it usually takes 10 or 15 hours is because the student needs the law of exercise. They have to practice, improve, and practice. That takes time, hours and hours. So here's my trick. We practice and drill in the mind. Don't get ahead of me now and think visualization. That's not what I'm talking about, and we'll get to that in a minute. For me to successfully accomplish this flight in less than 2 hours, I must devise a way so that the student can feel and mentally perceive as if they have been doing these tasks for hours. How do I do that? I train the nervous system. See, the nervous system cannot tell the difference between imagination and reality. Let me demonstrate that to you. Imagine for a moment that I told you that my fingernails were very long and I'm going to rub them across a chalkboard. Most people react to that. How so? There is no chalkboard and you can't even see me. When I told you that I was going to rub my fingernails across a chalkboard, you heard that and then you may have actually pictured it. Then you just saw a picture in your mind or you imagined it and your nervous system reacted. Now, whether you realize it or not, understanding the nervous system is a very powerful tool. Now, let me demonstrate how I use this in the real world of this 2-hour flight experience. Now, I will first take a student up for about, I usually start off for about 30 or 40 minutes. And in that 30 or 40 minute time frame, I have them taking off the airplane for the first time. I have them climb the aircraft. I have them turn left and right. They go up and down, and they go through some additional maneuvers. Then we land after doing some touch and goes. Now at this point, they are extremely stressed out and their brain is totally overloaded. Now once the airplane is parked, I have them stay in the pilot seat and I have them try to relax as much as they possibly can. I give them about 10 minutes to do this. The next step for them is to now train the nervous system. I actually have them mentally go over everything from the starting of the engine to the landing. in a way that you could say at this point they are visualizing, but we need to go beyond that. Visualizing does not really train the nervous system. I want this person to incorporate as many senses as possible. Here's a very important point. With regards to the nervous system, the goal here is to imagine what you're doing to the degree that you react and feel as if it were real or very close to it or as close as possible. Now, here's something else that I teach my 2-hour flight experience student to do that I think you might find interesting. Now, when teaching an athlete to visualize, most sports psychologists teach the person to see themselves making the goal and to visualize everything as positive as possible. I teach them to visualize not only positive things, but negative things too. See, in the real world, everything isn't positive or perfect. It's more effective in my mind's eye to train yourself imagining the negative and then in your mind taking corrective measures to solve the problem. See, by training the nervous system in this way, you're automatically preparing to make the needed adjustments to win. If you don't prepare for the negative in the imagined world, it will usually be too late when trying to correct it in the real world. Now, of course, there's some exceptions to this rule. Let's continue. Let me at least give you some examples of how this would work. Once I have my student on the ground and we've landed and he's in a relaxed state of mind after his first 45 minutes of flight, I then walk him through the entire flight. See, the landing is the part that's going to kill you. So there is a real skill in teaching someone to land in a very short time. See, the challenge in teaching this is the fact that the student doesn't really have much real life experience. At this point, they literally have about 3 landings under their belt. So I now have them imagine and role play making any mistakes or problems that they had encountered or had on the landing. Maybe the wind blew them off course a bit. So I have them imagine that the wind blew them off course, what some might perceive as negative, and then I have them imagine making the necessary correction. I need to try to get them to imagine it in such a way that they actually feel the intensity or the tenseness in their body from the stress of the wind blowing them, and then help them make the steps to make things correct or right in their mind or with the nervous system. I have them physically moving their hands in the cockpit just as if they would move their hands in the real flight, even though right now they're on the ground. And I have them verbally say out loud what's going on and what needs to be done. Now let me share with you how I use this knowledge to assist a professional golfer with his game. His challenge was that when he got to the point his next shot really counted, he would choke and he got so nervous he would blow the shot. My goal was to teach him how to relive the negative thoughts and emotions that he would experience just about when he would get ready to take his next swing and then blow it. Then in his mind, before taking the shot, I have him figure out how to take corrective measures both verbally and non-verbally so he can take back his control to execute a winning putt or swing. Now, for me to figure out how to take corrective measures, he must have something to correct. What is it that he has to correct? Anything negative that's preventing him from getting superior results. So in training the nervous system, I actually have him imagine the crowd booing him. I might go that far. Or maybe it's very windy, or I have him feeling nervous. His next step would now to counteract this mentally. We literally could go on and on for hours as to how this can be specifically done in different areas of life. This particular program, of course, is not designed to teach you in-depth techniques on programming the nervous system, but my goal is to aid you in seeing the many possibilities of the human mind. The next law that we're going to discuss is the law of effect. This law is based on the emotional reaction of the learner. It states that learning is strengthened when accompanied by a pleasant or satisfying feeling, and that learning is weakened when associated with an unpleasant feeling. Now, if, for example, a teacher tries to teach a student too much information or something beyond the student's capabilities, it could really do more harm than good because they can actually become very discouraged. And I think we've all experienced that before. Now, on the other hand, an experience that produces feelings of defeat or frustration or anger or confusion or futility are unpleasant for the student. And unfortunately, we've probably all experienced that one too. In large, I agree with this, but there are certainly exceptions. The exception depends on the student. those students experience something that produces feelings of defeat or frustration, anger, confusion, or futility, it doesn't mean that this is necessarily bad. Again, I emphasize that all this depends on the student. See, the teacher has to have enough skill and enough insight to determine who or what personality type can handle what. Let me share with you an example of this. It's when I first learned to fly helicopters. Now, before I started flying helicopters, I had flown airplanes for years. Being that helicopters fly so much differently than airplanes, the experience that I had developed with airplanes couldn't be applied to learning to fly helicopters. Now, I vividly remember the first few lessons. Now, one of the first skills that you're taught to master is to hover the helicopter. And let me tell you, that takes some practice. And I tried over and I tried and I tried, but I couldn't get it. And I hate to admit it, I literally had points where I just wanted to quit. The reason for these thoughts is that I had produced feelings of what? Feelings of defeat, frustration, and anger. So at this point, the instructor really has two choices. These choices are really or should be dependent on the student's personality and attitude. My instructor can continue teaching me to try to hover at the present pace and take the chance of discouraging me even further because I'm producing feelings of defeat and frustration, or he can slow down the pace and teach me other skills that are simpler in an effort to build my confidence back up. So, which road of teaching would he or should he choose for me? Again, it really depends on my attitude and personality type. See, my track record, especially in life, is one that does not want to be defeated. I'm the type that doesn't want to give up. So I also like an incredible challenge. So for me, I want to continue learning to hover at the present pace, knowing how exhilarated I would feel once I finally accomplished the task, even though there was a risk of me being very discouraged. But once I mastered that task, what an incredible feeling it was. But for the most part, whatever the learning situation, it should contain elements that affect the students positively and give them a feeling of satisfaction. You know, we discussed earlier that if a teacher tries to give a student too much information or something beyond the student's capabilities, it could do more harm than good because they can easily become discouraged. Now, if you overload a student's brain, they're going to stop learning. It's like filling up a glass with water. Once the water reaches the rim, it's full. You can keep trying to pour more water into the glass and more, but it's going to be useless. It will just spill over no matter how big the glass is. Why? Because it has its limit. Now, when I try to teach something that's very challenging, such as a 2-hour flight experience, I try to create a measuring rod for me to determine when the student's mind is full to the extent that they cannot assimilate any more knowledge or information. Now, the reason I need to know this is because if their mental glass is full, I'm wasting my time trying to give them more knowledge. And in addition, I risk the chance of really discouraging them. So here is how I accomplish this. As I'm flying with the student, I am constantly throwing new knowledge and new skills at them. And in this busy environment, I must release a bit of information or knowledge at a time. So how do I know when I should give them more? I simply ask them one question. The question is, can you accept any more information? At this point, if they're really overloaded, they may not even be able to answer the question. It's really quite amazing to watch. Obviously, if they can't even answer the question or they hesitate for several seconds before answering it, that is my cue or that tells me that they need more time to swallow what I've already given them. Now, there are other signs that I look for. I know that the student cannot take on any more information if they are concentrating so much that they can't even carry on a conversation. See, these are the little signs that a good instructor will look for so that they don't overload the person that they're trying to teach. The next law that we're going to go over is the law of primacy. Primacy is the state of being first, which often creates a strong, almost unshakable impression. Now, what this simply means is that what is taught needs to be taught right the first time. See, for the student, it means that learning must be right. Believe me, unteaching is more difficult than teaching. I guess a good example of this is trying to teach someone to type. You know, most people started typing without any type of instructions. Get it? Any type of instructions? Oh, well. They see a keyboard, and they look for the correct letters, and they start pecking away. You may know exactly what I'm talking about. They will now start to develop typing habits that are not good. Now, let's say they want to learn to type the right way, and boy, does that become difficult. Just about every time they touch the keyboard with the right techniques, they're having to break a bad habit because they weren't taught how to type the correct way the first time they started. So every student should be started right. The first experience should be positive and functional and lay the foundation for all that is to follow. Now let's talk about the law of intensity. See, a vivid, dramatic, or exciting learning experience teaches more than a routine, boring experience. A student is likely to gain greater understanding if they do rather than simply read about how things are done. So the law of intensity then implies that a student will learn more from the real thing than from a substitute. In contrast to merely teaching and hands-on, the classroom imposes limitations on the amount of realism that can actually be brought into teaching. So the instructor should use imagination in approaching reality as close as possible. For example, you can use mock-ups or color slides, movies, charts, posters, photographs, and other visual aids which can add vividness to the classroom instruction. Now recall earlier in the program that I told you that I will slap a student's hand when they're taxiing the airplane if they reach over to grab that yoke? Not only am I shocking the nervous system, I'm also applying the law of intensity. I'm making the training fun, vivid, and definitely dramatic. Now, the final law in this segment that we're going to discuss is the law of recency. The things most recently learned are best remembered. Conversely, the further a student is removed time-wise from the new fact or understanding, the more difficult it is to remember it. Now, I'm sure you've heard the saying that if you don't use it, you'll lose it, or repetition is the mother of retention. Now, from an instructor's viewpoint, it is very important to repeat, restate, or re-emphasize important matters at the end of a lesson to make sure that that student remembers them. The law of recency often determines the relative positions of lectures within a course of instruction. Now, with all this said and done, how could we use this law to increase our learning potential, and could we remember things that are not recently learned? Something to think about. Opposite of what that law states. The reason that I've thrown these questions at you is that I want to give you alternative thinking, if you will. I don't want you to accept everything that I'm told, so here's my twist. One of the challenges that I had when I wanted to get my captain's rating to fly a Learjet was how would I be able to keep the knowledge fresh in my mind if I can't afford to fly the jet on a regular basis? $1,500 to $2,000 per hour for a jet isn't chump change, and that will stop many people from flying a Learjet on a regular basis. Now, back to the if you don't use it, you'll lose it. So once I started to fly the jet, I would write a synopsis of everything that I didn't do as well as I would like to have. I would write it in such a way that if I would read it a year or two later, I would recall the trip as if I had just landed. Now, what this did for me is help me keep the flight fresh in my mind even though I flew it a year ago. I take detailed notes, I video some of my training, and I watched it regularly. So this is just another way to do things if you understand the law of recency.